Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In January 1889, as London constables hunted for Jack the Ripper and theaters around the world presented theatrical renditions of the Jekyll and Hyde story, Jackson, Michigan, police captain Jack Boyle searched for the murderer of Mary Latimer. This book follows Captain Boyle to the bordellos of Gaslight-era Detroit, populated by madams, pimps, prostitutes, and gamblers. It describes the investigation that led him to a pharmacist that prowled the streets, akin to a real-life Jekyll and Hyde. Ultimately, the book delves into the mind of Robert Irving Latimer, known as the most dangerous prisoner in Michigan, and the man who inspired talk about resurrecting the state's long-dead death penalty. The book we're featuring this evening is Pardonable Matricide, Robert Irving Latimer, From Michigan's Most Dangerous Inmate to Free Man, with my special guest, journalist and author, Tobin T. Book. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Tobin T. Book.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you very much. We're going to go way back in history to the late 1800s here. And first off, tell our audience how you came to want or come to be in a position to write this book, Pardonable Matricide.
I have been writing about historic true crime primarily from my base in Michigan for a long time, for a number of years, and that began with some investigation work that I did as a volunteer in the Kent County Morgue, which was research for my first two books, which were Cause of Death and Skeletons in the Closet. And they were a way for people to take a look at, see what really happens inside of a morgue, as opposed to the kind of televised reality that you see about morgues on TV. And I love history, and so they kind of came together. And in there are a couple of cases that are just delightfully delicious. It's probably the wrong word to say in this context, but they're really twisted and interesting. And one of them was the Irving Latimer case. And I had read some paragraphs here and there about the case, but nothing book length. And when I started to look into it, as often happens with my writing, I discovered that there was a much more to the story than had been told before. So I started digging. And the rocks that I uncovered, the story that I found underneath there, is Pardonable Matricide.
Now, this story centers around a place, Jackson, Michigan, that we introduced. So first, tell us a little bit about Jackson, Michigan, and its location, and then talk about a case that influences this case and also introduces pretty well all the main characters, especially in law enforcement and prosecution, the Jacob Crouch case. So in 1883, in November, you talk about that case. So tell us a little bit about Jackson, Michigan, and this case that sets up this very, very infamous case in 1888.
In the 1880s, Jackson was a mid-sized Midwestern town that was located, it's in southeastern Michigan, located between Detroit and Chicago. So any of the early traffic that was going from east to west or vice versa would have passed by that area. So it became kind of a major stop for trains. Its significance in our area's history is that it housed the state's first maximum security penitentiary. And that would be the only facility for long-term inmates until, I believe it was 1889 or 1890, when they opened up a second branch in Michigan's UP. So Jackson is an interesting situation because it's a city within a city. Most of the I wouldn't say both, many of the industries that were at work in Jackson were collateral to or supported by the prison itself. What's interesting about this and how it's different from today is that prisoners, when they were sentenced to prison, were sentenced to work at hard labor. Someone was given a sentence of 20 years at hard labor, and the hard labor was supplied by manufacturers who essentially purchased labor through the prison. So a lot of, like Jackson Wagon Company, which made wagons for Nationwide, had a factory literally inside the walls of the prison. So Jackson State Penitentiary is actually called the Michigan State Penitentiary. Jackson State Penitentiary at various times in its history was the largest walled prison in the world, and part of the reason for that is because inside the walls they had all these prison industries which were really run by private firms in and around the Jackson area. So it's fascinating because it's a city within a city. It was a family that was murdered in cold blood, and the case has never really been solved. How it's relevant to pardonable matricide and the Irving Latimer case is that most of the major players, if not all of the major players, right down to the prosecutor and the defense attorneys, had played some type of role in that case. And what's fascinating is that the world was so different back then. When these investigators went to take a look at the crime scene, they allowed the public full view of the crime scene. And so you had reporters and members of the public who were just morbidly curious wandering in and around the Crouch farmhouse. And that led to a little bit of a backlash because there was some criticism that the crime scene had been spoiled by all of the feet that had gone through that. So when the Latimer case came up and Mary Latimer was found slain in her bedroom, they closed off the crime scene to everybody but a reporter. I think there was one lone reporter in the house at the time, during the time of the investigation.
So now we fast forward to 1888. Tell us about the background of Robert Irving Latimer and his mother. Tell us about his family background, as you write.
They were natives of Jackson. His dad was to business as a pharmacist, and he had dreams of something bigger, and they moved out to the East Coast for a while, where his dad opened up a factory. It ultimately folded. Irving Latimer spent his formidable teen years there, and he acquired a reputation very early on as a ladies' man. We call him a skirt chaser today, a roué, whatever term you want to use. There were all kinds of lascivious rumors going on about an affair he might have had with an older woman. The family relocated back to Jackson when Irving Latimer was, I believe, in his late teens. And his dad went back into business as a pharmacist, and eventually Irving Latimer followed in his dad's footsteps and purchased the Westside Pharmacy after his dad unexpectedly passed away. And he went into the family business, so to speak, and became a pharmacist. The family itself was very well known in Jackson. They were very well respected. They were not what you would call upper class. You'd call them more like middling class or middle class. The house was a kind of a standard-sized 1880s, 1890s style house, not real big. But it was real close to a part of Jackson where the upper crust families did live in their Victorian mansions. And I think that Latimer had a little bit of an eye for that lifestyle. Now, he became, I think that there is essentially a public Latimer and a private Latimer. You mentioned in the introduction that he was very much a Jekyll and Hyde character, and I think that's really a great comparison because the Jekyll was the guy that everybody liked. He was the boy next door. He was the guy who dated the ex-sheriff's daughter. He was the guy who the families at the church, at the family church, wanted their boys to emulate. The Hyde was the guy that came out at night. He was the one who got high on his own supply. He was the one that took regular trips to Detroit, where he spent his time gambling and taking drugs and spending time in the red light district with prostitutes. The mother and the father were really well respected. But I think that Latimer's reputation eventually caught up to him. He got involved in a couple of scandals that pretty much ruined his reputation when he was in his 20s.
Now, you talk about Mary Latimer and this West End pharmacy, and of course, looks like, for all appearances, that Robert has learned something from his father about running a business, and this is the West End pharmacy. But tell us what the conditions are that he gets the money for the pharmacy. Tell us that how that comes to be.
Well, what the conditions are that he gets. The father passes away unexpectedly. The father's insurance is split between the mother and the son. And the son uses his share to buy the West End pharmacy. And the pharmacy was a small pharmacy, and it was one of only several in the area, but it was real prosperous. So, theoretically, the book should have been written in nothing but black ink. But they were written in red, and he acquired all kinds of debt because of the hide in him. He was out spending his money at night gambling and womanizing and visiting brothels in Detroit. So the pharmacy itself would have been a really good business for him. But he had a lot of vices that sort of got in the way of that. So I think he learned the business from his father, but I don't think he really learned business sense from his father.
You talk about the pharmacy, too. Before we get into January 25th, 1889, but you talk about the pharmacy and the availability of narcotics at that time. As you write, tell us some of the drugs that were available to a person like Latimer, if so inclined.
If so inclined, Latimer could have gotten his hands on any or all of the following substances: cocaine, and that is, I think, his drug of choice. He was spotted at one point in time walking around the other pharmacies trying to get his hands on it. Heroin could have been gotten over the counter. Opium, morphine, and then mixtures of them, like laudanum, which is a mixture of opium and alcohol, and then paregoric, which I believe is a mixture of tincture of opium and alcohol, which is even stronger than laudanum. And people didn't really understand the concept of addiction like they do today. So these substances would have been available over the counter for people as headache remedies. I have a drug label from a Michigan pharmacy, just for example, that is paregoric, and it's listed as 47.5% alcohol spiked with 1.9 grains of opium. So it would be like a 93 proof glass of whiskey spiked with the opium. And on the drug label, it gives the dosages, and the youngest is 3 months old, and they get a couple of the drops of this. And then a 10-month-old gets a few more drops, and then we go all the way to an adult who gets a full teaspoonful. So people took this stuff for headaches, and wow, it felt pretty good. So they started to use it without really a concept of addiction. And you don't have to go that far back in history. Like my grandfather predated penicillin. And, you know, when they got sick, they gave the kids a shot of rum. And it really didn't do anything except treat the symptoms, I think. But if you go back a generation earlier than that, they used even harder stuff. And in addition to this, he could have gotten substances beyond that. Substances such as chloroform was available over the counter. I had no idea what people used it for. Maybe if they had stepped on a nail or something and they wanted to take it out, put somebody out. People could have gotten their hands on strychnine and arsenic. And strychnine, which is a heavy metal poison, is a rather interesting substance because it was used as a rodenticide to kill rats in the granary. But believe it or not, strychnine in small doses at the time was used as that era's version of Valium or diazepam. It was a it was a anti-anxiety medication. So you could have gotten, if we had lived in that era, we could have gotten all kinds of stuff over the counter. Whatever will kill you, it'll cure you, right?
Sure. Now, let's get to January 25th, 1889, and as you write, Mary Latimer is 53 years of age at that time, and her son Robert Irving Latimer is her only child, and he keeps a bedroom at the family home, but as you write, he's rarely there, and he spends nights at the pharmacy, as a cot at the pharmacy. Now,
yes.
Mary's friend is someone named Kate Burroughs. Tell us what Kate Burroughs does when she's concerned about Mary being alone. Tell us what happens.
She's concerned about Mary being alone because Mary at this point in time is a widow and she's got a weak heart. And Kate's concerned about her health. And one day, one very early morning, she sees that the groceries have been dropped by the side door. And usually Mary would have been there to accept the groceries and bring them in. So right away she thinks that something might be wrong. So she goes to the house. And she runs into a paper hanger, so a wallpaperer who was doing some work for the Latimer family. And they go in through the basement up into the kitchen, and there they find the dog, Jip. And I think the dog had bloody footprints that he was tracking around the house, but they go up the staircase to her bedroom, and that's where they find her kind of a bloody mess. She had been beaten. She had been shot. She had been slumped over a chair. And it looked like what happened was she was trying to get to the window, perhaps to open it and call out when she collapsed and died.
Now, you say right away there's a response from Police Chief Eugene D. Winnie and Captain Jack Boyle. What do they find in terms of, and right away, what might be the motive for this killing? And what do they find in terms of any other physical evidence present?
So the physical evidence that they find, some interesting physical evidence that they didn't entirely understand at first, was in the Latimer bedroom where Robert sometimes slept. They found a blood-spattered handkerchief that they thought perhaps the killer had gone in there to wipe his hands. They also found some blood spots on the pillow itself. Now, one of the theories was is that the dog had taken the handkerchief off of the floor and jumped up on that bed and carried the blood with it, but it didn't quite seem to fit. They also found some blood stains on a gas jet. But probably the single most compelling piece of evidence that they found would have been Mary's dentures, which is essentially been, I think, blown and sprinkled across the floor like marbles, I think is how I described that in the book. Now, what I mean by it being important is that she essentially bit down on her attacker, they thought. And when they did narrow down the field, it turned out that the attacker had a damaged thumb and that the damage on the thumb would have perfectly fit her bite had he attacked her from behind. So they were able to, I think, use that to pair up the killer with the victim. Now, kind of an interesting thing about this, though, is the way they handled evidence is a little bit different, and their theories, their underlying theories, is a little bit different than it was today. And in part, this is why I enjoy writing about historical crime so much, is because it's so different than it is today. Now, when we get to the crime scene, here's a pretty good example of a piece of evidence they really wanted to find, which they thought would be like a smoking gun type of proof, but they never did find because the science doesn't support it. And that's something called forensic optography. It was assumed at the time that the human eye functioned just like a camera. I think the optics are somewhat similar. The physical processes behind how a camera took a picture and how the eyeball worked were somewhat similar. And that led to the conclusion that a person captured on their eye an image of the last thing they saw. In a murder case, that would inevitably be the killer. So in cases like this era, they would take a camera and they would prop it up over the body and they would try to take photographs of the eyes and analyze that for the possible image of the killer, which there's no science behind this. It's maybe a pseudoscience is what we call that today. But it's a really interesting example of how they did things differently than they did today.
You also talk about that they question neighbors and they are mystified that the dog doesn't bark for this supposed intruder, and no one hears any but as soon as they come to the crime scene, the dog barks. So that's put in their little book in terms of notable things about this crime scene, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because the dog is capable of barking. It's an old, aged dog that's on its last leg, so to speak, but it's capable of barking, and it does, in fact, bark when others are around. When strangers are around or people the dog isn't quite familiar with, why the dog doesn't bark? Because the person who came in and killed Mary Latimer wasn't a stranger, at least not to the dog, Jip. So, again, that's an interesting piece of evidence that suggested it tended to show that the killer may have been intimately equated with Mary Latimer in some way, shape, or form. Brought Robert to he was in Detroit at the time, and he came back to Jackson, and he was interviewed in the house with the body still slumped over the chair in the next room. And curiously, he had no interest whatsoever in seeing his mother's body. His affect was off. He didn't seem like he acted like a man who had just lost his beloved mother. And even more suspiciously, he offered up an alibi that just seemed a little too perfect. That combined with the fact that Jip knew the killer and that Robert Irving Latimer had an injured thumb, they started to put one and one together, and they didn't necessarily like what they came up with, but he seemed like the most logical suspect.
Now, how do they go about investigating and proving or disproving this perfect alibi?
So they send Jack Boyle to Detroit to basically backtrack to follow in Latimer's footsteps and find out what he was doing. And they interview the personnel at the hotel that he stayed in. And basically Latimer's alibi was that he had checked into the Griswold Hotel in downtown Detroit. And during the hours of the crime, he was fast asleep in his bed. Well, they interviewed some of the hotel personnel. The maid in particular was of importance here. And they were all convinced that Latimer never slept in the bed, although he attempted to make it look like he slept in the bed. So there's a missing period of time. And it's that missing period of time, which he says he's asleep in the bed, that they try to find out where he actually was. Now, Boyle goes and identifies a barber who shaved Latimer the next day, and the barber tells him that Latimer's got all this blood spots on his shirt and on his clothes, and he even wants to go and use the wash basin to clean up. So that's suspicious. Then Boyle starts looking at the train timetables and interviews train personnel, and it turns out that train personnel swore they saw Latimer on a train that was headed to from Detroit to Jackson around midnight and saw him return on a train sometime around 4 o'clock in the morning. So it appeared that what he attempted to do was set up a perfect to Detroit, checking into a hotel, sneaking out of the hotel, jumping onto a train for Jackson, doing the dirty deed, and then getting back on a train for Detroit and going back, sneaking back into the Griswold Hotel and telling everybody that he had slept during the time frame of the crime. And it's kind of interesting because he had given himself a little bit of an out. And I don't know if he had intended to do this when he engineered the perfect alibi, but his out was when they told him, look, you know, we don't think, you know, we think you're on these trains. We think you came back to Jackson. He had kind of a pocket story that he was looking for this woman named Trixie, and he thought he saw her go onto a train headed east, and he followed her on the next train and wound up in Jackson, and he didn't find her, so he wandered around so he could catch the next train and never did go home. So when he finally fessed up to that story, he put himself in Jackson during the time frame of the murder.
There are searches of the home that yield some surprises and some evidence. There are further investigations to find out some financial dealings that Robert had with his mother. Tell us how it comes to be that they find out this new supportive evidence.
They have a man who was responsible for looking into taking care of Mary Latimer's estate, and he was responsible for putting the house up for sale when Robert Irving Latimer was being tried for the crime. During investigated, jailed, and tried. And he was going through some drawers, and he found some evidence, some papers that indicated that Robert Irving Latimer had borrowed a significant sum of money from his mother, and so she was his creditor. And the payment was coming due. I think it was coming due in January of 1889. And so there was a fiscal motive for killing Mary Latimer, because that way he could get himself out of having to make the payment and inherit her money and pay off his other creditors. So he had some financial motives for doing for the crime. So not only was he in Jackson at the time, but he also had the means and the opportunity.
You talk about the media's role in this case, and you also talk about the media's role with the judiciary. You talk about their being at the crime scene, at the Crouch crime scene, where not only did they let the public in to see things like the body still there, but also that the media had, a bigger responsibility and at least more privileges when it came to the judiciary and the courtrooms. So what was the take on this? And again, this is called matricide. So how serious did the press take this, and what was the public's response?
The press took this really seriously. This became headline news, of course, in Jackson, but also throughout Detroit. All Detroit papers ran with it and covered it front page news for a long time, right up through the trial and the conviction. And not only that, but the case filtered outward and made headlines in the big rags throughout the United States. So this was something that the press kind of seized on, and I think the reason for that is because of the matricide element. It's extremely uncommon to commit matricide, for a matricide to occur. You wouldn't think that would be the case, but it is. Usually when it's done, it's a man killing the mother, and usually it's done in a bedroom, in a location that they're both very familiar with. So there's been enough cases over the last 100 years to create a profile, and it's amazing how closely he fits the profile right down to the age range, but there hasn't been that many cases. Matricide is really, really uncommon. Now, the murder of one's lover or spouse is called uxoricide, and that's much, much more common. But the fact that it was a matricide in this era in particular really I think triggered off sort of a media storm about the case itself. That was something that the media in most cities had never heard of or even conceived of before, was the killing of one's mother. And then there were other interesting facets of it too, the Jekyll and Hyde aspect. I mean, the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Hyde, I think, was first published in the mid-1880s, I want to say, without looking, 1885 perhaps. And so they used the term Jekyll and Hyde to refer to him. So here you have a case of a real-life Jekyll and Hyde that fit the fictional version pretty well, which people had pretty much known by this point because it had been performed in theaters all over the place. So the media not only took it seriously, but they tended to really investigate. They had reporters who were running around and following his footsteps. They had reporters who were on the streets interviewing people, trying to find angles, trying to figure out what's going on, interviewing the women in his life. I wouldn't say that they were incredibly intrusive. With male suspects in this era, they often didn't have access to them once they went behind bars, which wouldn't have been true for females because of the possibility of a scandal. Female suspects were almost always interrogated in full view of the press, and press were even allowed to ask questions, which creates an interesting layer for a researcher that isn't there for male suspects. So in this particular case, I wouldn't say they were necessarily intrusive, but probably the most insidious facet of the media attention in this case was their inability to secure a jury. The defense lawyer, during their voir dire, basically eliminated everybody he could that had heard about the case, and that was pretty much everybody because it had been published so widely in the press.
You talk about the preliminary attracting all kinds of attention, so they didn't wait till the trial. So it was the preliminary that created all kinds of interest. And interestingly, too, even though this was a rogue, and you talk about his character really not having any use for any of his friends, there were people that he had encountered and acquaintances and business partners, I guess, or business acquaintances that really firmly believed that he could not have done this.
Is yeah, I think he was a hard, I think he, if he was alive today, I think he'd be the life of the party. He'd be the guy that always got a circle of people around him at a party, women in particular. They're laughing, he's telling jokes. He'd be an extremely charismatic individual to a degree. But I think getting to know the real Robert Irving Latimer, he was a hard man to get to know. And I think he tended to use people and dispose of them like they were Kleenex. So, again, that's that part of that Jekyll and Hyde type of vibe that he had. The interesting thing about that I find about trials of the era is you have to keep in mind the context. This is an era before there were reality TV shows, before there was shows like Law and Order and those type of things. And the press, I think, in the 1880s, they had pretty much expurgated anything that was really spicy. And I mean, you have to kind of read between the lines when they talk about prostitutes. They don't use the word prostitute very often. They use a series of synonyms that are a little less racy, you might say. I mean, after all, this is an era where tablecloths go right to the floor, and because they didn't want guys looking at the legs of the table, because sooner or later they're going to start looking at the real thing. I mean, that kind of conservatism, yeah. You know, that affected all aspects of life. I mean, people had coined the term drumstick, so they didn't use an anatomical term. I mean, it went to. I saw a picture of two women who were dragged off to a paddy wagon in a paddy wagon. In Chicagoland, because they weren't wearing their bathing suits, they went right down to the ground. And what's crazy about that is that photograph, they're wearing skirts, and they have bobby socks on, and the only skin that's exposed is their kneecaps, and that was enough to get them a jail stint. People go to trials, and in trials, the testimony isn't expurgated. So they can get the very best of reality TV, so to speak, and they can get it unadulterated, unedited. And so at the Latimer trial, because he had tried to alibi himself by saying that he was at a bordello, they actually called the madam and some of the prostitutes up to testify. And the existence of these ladies, having them dragged into the public, into the daylight, would have been utterly scandalous, let alone what they had talked about. And so for people, this was the very height of drama, and the part of the community that particularly loved this were the ladies. I've done a tremendous amount of writing about trials that take place in that era, say 1880 to 1920, and invariably you hear the line that the audience is made up of 80% women, and the women in the audience have overflowed the aisle, the seats in the courtroom for them. You even hear news reporters who are angry because they have to try to crane their necks to see over the women who are sitting there with their big brimmed hats on. So right away, as you mentioned, from the preliminary hearing, you've got, because of all of these facets, and what makes this case even more interesting to people is the bordello aspect and the matricide aspect. So, and added to which, he was a really, really popular fellow in Jackson, very well known.
Let's use this as an opportunity just to stop for a moment to talk about our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star-rated mobile puzzle game. Discover the world of Minutia and its cute, courageous inhabitants in this friendly, fun, free-to-download puzzle adventure. I'm on level 30 right now. I just started recently, and I got to say, I'm a novice. So you don't need to be a gamer to play this game. All the levels are getting a little more difficult, but I got to say, I got Quincy, the good guy, in the first try. Immediately, I noticed the vivid colors and the impressive visual style of Best Fiends. From the start of playing, it's been the cool story and the challenges and solving puzzles that's kept me interested. Again, I mentioned I was a novice, so you don't need to be a gamer to enjoy playing this. I'm usually all serious, so this is, for me, fun, free, and I'm really into it. Thousands of hours of gameplay, it's easy to learn, but difficult to master. Challenge your brain with fiendish puzzles that require strategy to succeed. Star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Over 90 million downloads globally. Play offline anywhere. Perfect when you want to squeeze in another level on the go. Don't miss out on this must-play game of the year. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Play today. Now, we talked about the trial of, basically, you call it the trial of the century, the anticipated interest in this trial, never mind from the preliminary, it continued to the actual trial. You say with all the people that were anticipating this, especially the women, but let's talk about what the prosecution, who the prosecution is, and talk about the defense, which is an attorney named Barkworth.
Barkworth and Parkinson, I believe, is the prosecuting attorney. It's funny, I have to go back and actually look at the book. So they're both well-known lawyers in their area. Both of them played a role in the Crouch case. They would go on to, Parkinson would go on to become a judge, a really well-known judge, and Barkworth would go on to become a member, I believe, of the Michigan House of Representatives. So we're talking about some pretty good legal minds here, and Parkinson was handed a pretty good case. He had motive, he had means, opportunity, and he had some forensic evidence. And he always proceeded on what they would call the mercenary motive, and that was Robert Irving Latimer killed his mother for no other reason than to stay clear of the debt and to wire her money so that he could pay off his other debts and continue to live the life of Riley, if you will, do what he wants to do in Detroit. Barkworth had a little bit harder job. Barkworth had to try to explain how in the world his client had come to be in Jackson at the same time that the crime was taking place, why he lied about it in the first place, and tried the best to try to keep his client out of that bedroom, out of that house at the time. And this is where we get into a woman named Trixie. Beatrice LaRue was her real name, and she was essentially held up as his alibi, except no one could find her. And I think she might have headed west, and they perhaps changed names, but one thing is certain, she never made an appearance at the trial. And what's interesting is that the anticipated women who knew Latimer anticipated that he was going to try to pull one of them in as an alibi. And there were several reputations, I think, that were ruined as a result of their relationship to a known roué, because he was looking for somebody who could be convenient. And ultimately, he picked kind of a concrete and interesting scenario, because where is Beatrice? Did she exist? Did she not exist? Did she exist in pseudonym only? It's kind of a fascinating story, and kind of a fascinating sub-story, really.
You talk about, meanwhile, at the same time this is going on, there's a dynamic in terms of in the courts and in the public, and, of course, to a certain degree, the media, in terms of the death penalty bill. Explain that.
Michigan is a state hasn't had the death penalty for state crimes. The last man hanged for state crimes in Michigan, it was Michigan territory in the 1830s. His name was Stephen Simmons. He was a tavern owner who slugged his wife. He came home drunk one night, slugged his wife because she wouldn't drink with him. She fell back, hit her head, died, skull fracture, I think. And he was sentenced to death, and no one wanted to hang him. So the hanging was done by a fellow tavern owner and a long-term rival of Stephen Simmons. As the story goes, Simmons was a bit of a brute, but he was a real soft-spoken and eloquent man. And on the scaffold, he got up and said a prayer, and then he sang a hymn in a beautiful baritone. And people in the crowd, even those who were pro-death penalty, had in that instant turned against it. And when the state of Michigan came into being, one of the first things that the legislators did was ban the death penalty for state crimes. Now, I have to clarify that there have been people who have been put, and currently put on death row and even executed for crimes that occurred within Michigan's borders, but they would be crimes that were done in territory overseen by the federal government. So there is an individual on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana today for a crime that was committed in Manistee National Forest, which is the part where the crime was committed is overseen by the federal government. But state crimes, we don't have one. Now, over the course of our history, the death penalty comes up from time to time in a debate, and usually it's triggered by some type of really nasty crime or series of crimes or crime wave. Latimer and his crime and a crime of a fellow named Augustus Tonto basically led to a very vigorous debate as to whether a death penalty should be enacted in the state of Michigan, and it came very close to passing. What a lot of people don't know, when I speak about this, it's kind of fascinating that they don't know this, is that death penalty bill that was triggered by the matricide was going to involve three different types of executions. One would have been hanging, which would have made Michigan consistent with the other states at the time, hanging being a penalty that was the most common. Electrocution, the electric chair, had started to be installed in state prisons around the country. And the third one was the guillotine. They were going to bring a guillotine to Michigan and behead people as the ultimate punishment, and that would have been inspired by the crimes of Latimer. Obviously, it didn't get passed, but every now and again through our history, every dozen or so years, it comes up again. I think Latimer inspired three different conversations about a death penalty, and some of them got to be very, very, very close, in voting. Part of one of the second instances that he influenced the talk, I think Barkworth was one of the voices against it, and the problem they had was they didn't want to execute people who were convicted solely on circumstantial evidence. And he right. certainly had in mind Latimer, because Latimer was convicted on circumstantial evidence. Now, while that sounds sure. really may sound really bad in the 21st century, at the time, I think that was considered not so much problematic, because they didn't have the type of forensic science that we have today. So they couldn't conceive of something like a DNA match or even a fingerprint. So a lot of the evidence in murder trials of the case was, in fact, circumstantial.
Let's get to this. You call it the theater of the absurd. We're talking about April 1889. You talk about the things that were raised at this trial, but one of the most, I guess, visual things was the appearance of Mrs. Johanna Young behind her nephew. This is her nephew at trial. Tell us just a little bit about her appearance there, and as you write, some of the things that happen that also talk of his demeanor at trial.
Irving Latimer's demeanor at trial was
yes.
Odd. I mean, his affect was off, just like his affect seemed to be off when he gave his alibi and when he first came to his house with and talked to Boyle and Sheriff Winnie about where he was. And he didn't want to see his mom's body. His affect was off like that, too. He spent a lot of time reading the newspaper as if he was a man that didn't have a care in the world. He either had convinced himself that he was going to get out of it, or he really didn't care or understand the gravity of it. And that seemed completely odd and indifferent to everybody in the courtroom, who sort of expected him to be maybe tearful about the fact that his mother was being shot. Now, the interesting thing about Irving Latimer and his affect is when he was in jail, he seemed completely indifferent about his mother being being done. And he asked to be let out to go to her funeral. And they believed they were going to let him go to his mother's funeral. And he, at the last minute, changed his mind. And they thought that basically what he was trying to do was trying to drum up some support by looking to be devastated by his mother's loss. But when they actually called his bluff and said, okay, we'll go escort you to the funeral, he didn't go. So part of the theater of absurd is his entire demeanor in this entire play, if you will. It's kind of a tragic comedy.
You talk about they brought in the Madam Pinkerton into the courtroom, and of course this helped out the media and the public, but what did she bring in terms of evidence for the prosecution, or was she an effective for the defense? Which was she there for?
I think that in the long run, she probably was not effective at all. I think that she was brought in basically to say that she had known Latimer and that he had been at her establishment, but had left at a certain period of time. And here's where we get to the train timetables. He had left at a certain period of time, Detroit time, and it was enough for him to get back to the hotel and then get to the train and get to Jackson. So if he had attempted at one point in time to alibi himself by saying that he was there, but I think that her presence really, really harmed him. And it wasn't just in that way. It was proof that she knew him, that he was a known associate of a well-known Bravo owner, and that he had run up, you know, he had spent a lot of time there. I mean, in order to be intimately associated with him, he would have had to spend time there. And that is, I think, for the community who wanted to indemnify him, who were convinced of his good boy image, this was like pulling back the curtain to see the person really, even the real Robert Irving Latimer, and a guy who was intimately associated not just with Madam Pinkerton, but her, what they would have called inmates at the time, and not just one of them, but several of them. He had spent time in a brothel. He had spent money in a brothel. And that proved that he had run up debts. He was a roué, you know, a womanizer, and that he was intimately associated with a red light district. And I think that just kind of just helped make Parkinson's motives come to life. It put a face on it, because Parkinson, the whole time, his case was predicated on the idea that Robert Irving Latimer murdered his mother, A, get out of the debt, and B, to acquire her money so that he could continue to do these type of things. So I think that whatever the purpose of her going to the stand was, it was devastating for Robert Irving Latimer's defense.
Every move that Barkworth did on behalf of Latimer in terms of trying to find an alibi witness, someone that he was with, there was a couple attempts, and there was somebody that they found that was on a deathbed. They took an affidavit. Tell us briefly about these attempts and what is made of them.
I think, first of all, I think that Latimer probably was stringing along his lawyer. I do not think this was a situation where Barkworth knew the truth, that Latimer had confessed to him and he was reaching for straws. I think that he was actually quite frustrated with this continually evolving story that Latimer told. But as a defense attorney and a very good lawyer, he also understands that he's got to do his best to try to prepare defense. And so he goes and he interviews people. And I think Latimer had brought up a number of names of people who would give him an alibi. And so he goes to Detroit and interviews this woman, as you mentioned, that was on her deathbed. And, of course, she said that she wasn't even home at the time he came knocking. She was with a friend at that exact period of time. And what's kind of fascinating about this, though, is I wonder how truthful she really was. I mean, he was a bit of a virus for anybody at this point in time. Anybody to be associated with him was going to have a reputation killed, especially given the fact of how people were in the era with the way they handled sexuality and things like that. So a respectable woman in Detroit has an affair with a very good-looking younger man. Maybe she's even with him that night. Maybe she's even with him earlier in the night. She's not going to say it publicly. She's not going to probably even say it in an affidavit. So I think that there's a little bit of wiggle room there, to a little bit of reasonable doubt to suspect that she and maybe several others knew him, and I mean like in the biblical sense knew him, and at this point in time wanted to just distance themselves as best as they can. And you kind of wonder whether one of them actually was with him that night or part of that night. Doesn't mean he didn't do it. Doesn't mean he didn't have time to sneak back to Jackson. But he certainly knew these people. He didn't just pick them out of a hat. And so part of the interesting part of my research was trying to reconstruct Latimer's little black book, if you will, in an era where people didn't want to talk about this type of thing. And it was really, really, really tricky. So anyways, that's what that was all about. Barkworth was trying to find witnesses that I think his the rather troublesome client was bringing up as a desperate attempt to try to get him out of Jackson, or at least away from the house at the time the murder occurred.
You talk about Latimer. Again, this is rare in a murder trial that he took the stand. What was his demeanor? And tell us, what are some of the highlights of moments at trial when he testified?
I think that some of the highlights of the trial were some of the back and forth with the man that cross-examined him. I think that would probably be, if there was a climactic moment in the trial, that would probably be it. It was Parkinson's second chair, and he had characterized Latimer as being one of the swiftest, slyest criminals he had ever had come across. And he was just chomping at the bit to try to poke holes in Latimer's story. And I think that that bit of testimony is probably the most fascinating. And again, his this idea that he was hunting for this woman that no one was able to locate, no one was able to find, was nowhere in sight, that the sheer lunacy of the idea, the incredibility of the idea that he had taken a train to find her and just happened to be in Jackson at the exact same time that his mother was murdered, and that he was using this as a defense. And, of course, you have the ever-evolving story that he first said he had been in the Griswold Hotel and he hadn't been in the hotel. And what's really, when you research cases like this, this is where newspapers can really be a vital aspect of the research, because what happens too often is the trial transcripts, if you can even find them, are just Q&A. That's generally how they are, just Q, answer, A, answer. But to really get to the affect, you go to the reporters who sat in on the testimony, and this is where you can hear the voices and the tone. So the lawyer loses his temper and he raises his tone. That's not something that's going to come through the trial transcript, but that comes through the newspaper articles. Mm-hmm. So on a side note, the real key as a researcher is to try to find the most accurate newspaper articles, and the best way to do that in an era where they sensationalized everything is to find a trial transcript and compare the two. So you become, as a researcher, very much like a detective.
Very interesting. You talk about this cross-examination by Parkinson's partner, Conley.
Yeah.
And he...
Edwin.
He basically... hacks away at every bit of this alibi, and also he asks him things like, how did you cut your thumb, and he can't quite really answer, and like you say, he's chomping at the bit to really cross-examine him hard, and you say that he said, I don't recollect 269 times in that exchange.
Yeah.
You also talk about the show is psychopathology here. You also talk about a woman that he sees in the courtroom. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So at one point in time, Latimer sees a pretty lady who happened to come and watch the trial. And he makes a remark about how pretty she is. And so what the psychopathology is really, the affect, again, is really off, because here's a guy who is on trial for, I wouldn't say his life because we don't have a death penalty, but he's on trial for life in prison for the murder of his mother. His reputation is destroyed, basically. And ever the ladies' man, his mind is focused on a female attendee who he'd like to meet and date. And I think that to a certain degree, he was actually under the impression that he was going to beat this thing and be able to go out and date like that again. Either he's completely fooled himself, or you have an individual who has a real break with the idea of what reality is. Now, in some trials, particularly in later trials, say 20 years, you would suspect that that might be a put on. That might be a stratagem to try to prove that he is insane or mentally deficient in a way that would not make him culpable for a crime. But I don't think that's the case. I think that's the real Robert Irving Latimer that you're seeing there, a man who is so utterly self-centered, somebody who is so, the word would be narcissistic, I think, that he's only interested in the things that interest him at that moment. And that would be a characteristic of what we call a sociopath today, I believe. And that's kind of a fascinating question. Was Robert Irving Latimer a sociopath? They would, of course, had terms like that, they wouldn't apply them. So for me to talk about him being a sociopath is a bit like being a Monday morning quarterback. But if you look at the characteristics, somebody who lies and lies really well, somebody who is narcissistic, sexually uninhibited, these are all characteristics of that condition. So it's really fascinating. And I think Connolly at one point in time was so involved, emotionally invested in that cross-examination that he hammered his hand on the table to the point where it looked red like steak. So you can imagine the situation in the courtroom where he's thundering away at Robert E. Latimer. Every time Latimer says, "I don't recall," he gets angrier to the point where he's just bashing his hand on the table, on the lawyer's table, to make a point. And the end of the table, he's all hoarse, and his hand is red. It looks like hamburger. And he's heard, "I don't recall," 269 times.
You also talk about the flippant attitude by Latimer, and that he's reading a newspaper, and even when he's sentenced or the verdict is coming down, he's again pretending to read a paper, but as you say, he's crying behind that newspaper. Tell us about the verdict and how long it took for the jury to determine that verdict.
I believe that the verdict... I don't remember now offhand how long it took to make the verdict. I'd have to go back and look at the book exactly.
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Yeah, I thought it was real. I thought it was a really, really quick verdict. Now I remember what happened was people left the courthouse because they assumed that it was going to be a lengthy verdict, a lengthy deliberation, I should say, and they had headed down the street to go get dinner. They were checked into various restaurants and hotel cafes, and they were going to have dinner, and all of a sudden, they have dropped their forks and their spoons and run back to the courthouse because the verdict had come in so soon. And I think people crowded into the courtroom to the point where I think that the lawyers had to crawl through the windows because there was so much interest in what was going to take place. And sure enough, they sided with the prosecution and slammed the cell door on Irving Latimer, life in prison at hard labor.
Now, you would think that this story, as you write, that eventually this story, this is yesterday's news, but this story is still very, very big. And you talk about that right after this sentence, that by mid-May, this Latimer case becomes a headline exhibit in the Chamber of Horrors at Detroit's Wonderland Theater. Where you say vaudeville performances, circus acts, freak shows, and the most ghastly crimes of the era were preserved for posterity in wax. Very, very interesting. Now, tell us about Latimer's stay in prison, just briefly. What happens as he goes to prison?
Well, the previous prison administration was draconian in their treatment of prisoners. They used a whipping post. They had something called riding the horse, where they had like a hobby horse with a back that came to a square like back that they made prisoners sit on. So they treated people really harshly. And when that prison administration came to an end, the next incoming warden was a little bit too loose with the criminals, and So prisoners were allowed privileges, and they had a lax administration that either turned a blind eye or were just negligent on the things that prisoners were bringing in. And what do you do with a pharmacist when he's behind bars? Why, you let him sell medicines to the other inmates, of course. And so Latimer started to peddle patent medicines to the other inmates that he was allowed to freely bring into the prison. How far do you want me to go with what happens next?
Well, needless to say that he is not content with this. He's filed appeals. The appeals don't work, but needless to say, he doesn't want to stay in prison. So he hatches a plan to escape.
Yeah, he whoops up a batch of. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
He whoops up a batch of prussic acid, which is. Cyanide, and he prepares some spiked lemonade for a couple of prison personnel, and his plan is to poison them, and in the ensuing commotion, open up some of the cells and flood Jackson with a bunch of inmates to basically cover his own escape, and then just basically disappear gently into that good night. But it goes wrong, because one of the keepers that he poisons drops a whole bunch of dishes as he collapses onto the floor, and that alarms the other keepers, and Latimer has to sort of do an audible. He never gets to release the rest of the inmates, but he does get out of the prison, and his grand escape, which ultimately cost the life of one of the keepers, lasted about 2 days, I believe.
Yeah. From that escape, with the death of one of the keepers, the jailers, what is now the response from the media and from the public? And then what is the response towards this, as you say, lackadaisical attitude of this warden, Davis, at the Jackson prison?
Okay, so the prison started to tighten up how it handled allowing prisoners to bring stuff in from the outside. The prison clerk and a whole bunch of other people got in trouble, and a couple of them were actually tried for crimes, for negligence. As far as Latimer's concerned, he's put into a solitary cell for quite some time. I think months he's put into a solitary cell. The media calls for another discussion about the death penalty. And this time, I think that the death penalty cases that they wanted, the death penalty law they wanted to enact, would include cases of inmates who kill prison personnel. So the media now, all of a sudden, Robert Irving Latimer becomes front page news again. This is quite rare. I mean, this is not something that in the state of Michigan happened a lot. An inmate, well, it never happened. It never happened just personally anywhere. I mean, think about this: an inmate acquiring a deadly poison, cyanide, and using it to poison two prison officials. It's really kind of a bizarre, shocking case when you think about it.
Yeah. Yes, it changed everything with this escape and the murder of these two guards. Now, we have to talk about, when we mentioned in the introduction, we talk about the most dangerous inmate to free man. So let's just sort of jump ahead here. How on earth and how many years does it take for this person, and under what conditions in terms of how it is that they're able to let this person out? How many years does it take?
So he goes in 1889. I believe the trial's May, or the verdict is May. And he comes out in 1935, I want to say. And so he's in for 35, 46 years. I believe at the time, I'm sure at the time, that life in prison was essentially a 20-year prison sentence with the possibility of parole. But what changed things for Latimer were two factors. He only murdered one guard. The other one recovered and actually wound up on trial himself for negligence. The things that caused him to be rejected for parole/pardon by governor after governor after governor after governor were two factors. The murder of the keeper, and the matricide. Now, what's interesting about this is these governors had pardoned all kinds of murderers, male and female, over the years. There was a governor named Woodbridge Nathan Farron, who set a record for the number of pardons and paroles he gave around Christmas 1916. And Latimer was not one of them. And the reason that most people believed was the matricide. It was the nature, even more so than the murder of Keeper George Haight. It was the matricide itself. It was such an appalling crime. They just simply didn't want to let him out. It got to be so out of hand, the justice got to be lopsided because they had let out other people who had murdered people in sometimes less than 10 years. Sometimes 10, 15 years they did in prison and let them out. Latimer's in prison 46 years. And why? Because of the nature of his crime, the matricide. So he had some crusaders that were on his side, and it characterized his prison sentence as a political crime. Eventually, after pushing, Robert Irving Latimer was let out. But he was an old man. A side note about his story is that when he was let out, he was the only inmate left in the old Jackson State Penitentiary. They had opened up a new facility, and he didn't want to move. So he wound up being the old, in fact, they called him the warden of the old prison, and he basically had free use of the grounds. He could come and go when he wanted to. How bizarre is that? He's a lifer, murdered a guard, and he's free to come and go in the prison he wants to. He became very adept at landscaping around the prison, but not a free man, not till 1935.
You write, and I think it's fitting, that this institutionalized person that spent 46 years that kept protesting his innocence in this, that when he was released, he reached out to those unlikely people to help him. What was his state of affairs once he was released? I say fittingly.
Yeah, he was essentially impoverished. And he didn't... He didn't really know anybody. I mean, he was quite old, and I think that there were a couple of people, these crusaders, that were basically prison reformers, but I don't think he knew them real well, and some of his long-term champions had preceded him in death. So Robert Irving Latimer was kind of destitute. Now, he did have some options. I think he very briefly went to work for Ford Motor Company. He did get a chance to fly a plane for the first time, and he took a trip. But this is the height of the Great Depression, 1935, and so he fell into a state of utter despair. He wound up being homeless on a park bench.
Yeah. Very interesting. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about pardonable matricide. Robert Irving Latimer, from Michigan's Most Dangerous Inmate to Free Man. For those that might want to check this out, can you tell us if you have a Facebook page, website, or how they might find out more about this incredible case?
Yes, the publisher is McFarland, and McFarland has a page devoted to the book. Of course, it is for sale on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, I believe, has it for sale online. People can contact me through my website at www.tobinbook.com, and they can find information about my various publications and my speaking schedule to speak around the state. I also run a blog called Dark Corners of History, where people can go if they want to traipse around the darker corners of history and shine a flashlight in there and see what they can see.
Absolutely. Sounds great. I want to thank you very much for this interview, Tobin T. Buick. Thank you very much for this, and you have a great evening. Good night.
Dan, thank you so much for having me this evening.
Thank you. Good night.
All right. Good night. Hello.